The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to The Business of Giving. I'm your host, Denver Frederick, and we have an interesting hour ahead for you. We're going to begin with James Anderson, the head of Government Innovation Programs at Bloomberg Philanthropies. They foster innovation to help mayors solve problems and improve city life, and believe using data is a key piece of that.
We decided to focus on government uptake, mm-hmm. and how do we build the skills and the culture and the routines and the mindsets within government around using data that has as its ultimate expression and goal getting folks to use evidence in their daily decision making.
And then you'll hear from Jonathan Reckford, the Chief Executive Officer of Habitat for Humanity International. And although Habitat was not founded by President and Mrs. Carter, their involvement was transformational.
A pivotal moment really was in 1984 when President and Mrs. Carter got involved. Mm-hmm. And I actually just did the checking. I think cumulatively between 76 and 84, we had built 758 houses across the world. And you can really see the inflection point. After the Carters got involved, Habitat got a huge amount of attention, and their continued presence and so many people getting involved and taking leadership, we've now been able to help over 13 million people worldwide have new or improved housing.
But first, the Business of Giving News Digest for Sunday, August 26. Chicago-based biopharmaceutical firm AbbVie has announced a $100 million commitment to Ronald McDonald House Charities to provide essential support, including housing, meals, and education for hospitalized children and their families. The Princeton Review, a major test preparation and tutoring company, has laid off numerous employees this year as part of a corporate review and reorganization process. The cuts are one indication that the Princeton Review is struggling to maintain a hold on the industry it helped create. And the New York University School of Medicine has announced that it is offering full tuition scholarships to all current and future students in its MD program, regardless of need or merit. And that is a Business of Giving News Digest for this Sunday evening. I'll be back to speak with James Anderson of Bloomberg Philanthropies right after this.
I just finished months of chemo, but I don't want to talk about months. I want to talk about years. Treatments have gotten better, so I'm hoping for good years ahead. That's thanks to research funded by the American Cancer Society. The same folks giving me free rides to treatments, insurance advice, and a place to stay during chemo. I need that stuff like you don't know. And now that you do, please give at cancer.org.
If you're interested in reading transcripts of guests' interviews from The Business of Giving, you can find them at denverfrederick.wordpress.com. And now back to the show on AM 970, The Answer.
If you had to leverage something that would have a positive impact on the greatest number of people possible, you'd be hard-pressed to find anything better than making city mayors more effective at doing their jobs. And that is one of the focus areas for Bloomberg Philanthropies. And it's a pleasure to have with us this evening James Anderson, the head of Government Innovation Programs at Bloomberg Philanthropies. Good evening, Jim, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Thank you. It is great to be here.
Why don't we begin, Jim, by having you give us a brief overview of Bloomberg Philanthropies, its focus, and its approach.
Great. So Bloomberg Philanthropies is the umbrella that constitutes all of the different ways that Mike Bloomberg uses his philanthropy to make the world a better place. Our mission is to create greater, longer lives for the greatest number of people. And that brings us to cities across so much of the work that we do. We have a big focus on public health, mostly in low and middle income nations, on education reform here in the United States, on arts and culture around the world, on the environment, with a big focus on urban sustainability. And the programs I lead are focused on public sector innovation, overwhelmingly focused on helping local governments solve problems in new and more powerful ways.
Well, that is one interesting charge. How many cities worldwide are you currently supporting, whether through grants or technical assistance or the other kind of programs that you have at Bloomberg Philanthropies?
Across the entire organization last year, I think we engaged somewhere close to 400, 420 cities. Within the government innovation programs, I would say that's about 250 across a number of different continents. As you noted, that support takes a number of different forms. Sometimes we provide direct grants to local government to help them fund innovative new ideas to major urban challenges. We also provide a tremendous amount of technical assistance and coaching. We do a very significant focus on skills building and helping local governments learn the 21st century problem-solving skills that are common in the private sector, but not yet so in the public sector. And then we do educational and networking programs. Leadership development and idea sharing are big focuses for us.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get into some of those initiatives that you champion. Evidence-based, evidence-informed policymaking. That was certainly a hallmark of the Bloomberg administration here in New York City, and it's probably the best way to achieve, you know, positive outcomes for citizens. Speak to us of the challenges of doing this, because it's really not done as much as most people would like, and then of this initiative to see that it becomes more of a standardized practice.
So there's been a growing chorus of advocates and academics over the past 20 years focused on evidence-based policy. And when we started looking at this universe a couple of years ago, the observation that we made is that there seems to be a gap between the desire to use evidence and the actual uptake of evidence within government. Now, I came out of Mike Bloomberg's City Hall and was spoiled in a sense because he came into City Hall as the data guy.
Yep.
He built his business using data. Data is sort of the through line for his entire career. And he brought that culture into City Hall and oriented all of us around targets, data, charts. That was the currency of every single conversation. If you couldn't talk about it in data, Mike didn't really have patience for it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when we started looking at cities around the world, we heard mayors saying, yeah, I want to use data more often. I want to do more evidence-based policy. I know I'm funding things that aren't producing the highest and best value that I think we could be producing with those scarce public resources, but the knowledge gap was pretty significant. So we decided to not focus on expanding the universe of evidence, which is a focus that is important and many other actors are zeroing in on that. We decided to focus on government uptake and how do we build the skills and the culture and the routines and the mindsets within government around using data that has as its ultimate expression and goal getting folks to use evidence in their daily decision making. So we do that. We have one very significant investment. Mike has now put a total of somewhere close to $80 million in helping local governments develop the skills, the awareness, the routines to use data in their daily operational decisions, in their management, funding, and policy decisions. And we do that in a number of different ways.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us an example of where data has led to a better outcome, where it's been deployed intelligently?
I can give you a couple.
Mm-hmm.
We were doing some work with the mayor of Seattle, and Seattle, like many West Coast cities, is experiencing an extraordinary challenge with homelessness.
Yeah.
At the same time, the city of Seattle was really increasing its annual spend on homeless services, but they didn't think they were getting a better outcome. And so we brought in one of our incredible partners. In this case, it's the Government Performance Lab from Harvard University. And they started looking at the way that the city of Seattle was procuring homeless services. What were they actually purchasing with government dollars? And the long and short of it is that they were purchasing a lot of inputs and outputs, activities, in other words. Are you engaging people on the street? Are you getting them meals? Are you getting them showered? Are you providing them with medical assistance? But not necessarily the outcomes that everybody in the world wants for homeless people, which is how do we actually move you off of the streets and into a safer, more permanent housing situation? And so when you're paying for inputs and wanting outcomes, you're undoubtedly going to have a disconnect and you're not going to be making yourselves, your providers, your mayor happy. And so we went in and we helped them rethink the way that they were procuring homeless services. We socialized that with a small number of critical partners to get them on board, to test it. And now that has really scaled up, and they're now using that approach, I'm pleased to say, even beyond the homeless services arena, but more broadly in human services and youth services. Mm-hmm. So that's a great example of helping cities understand how you can pay for results rather than activities, and the pressure that that puts on the system. That's a really positive pressure for the people that you want to serve.
Yeah, that's a great example. You know, sometimes you wonder when you ask people about homelessness, and they'll say, oh, our homeless shelters are 99% full. And you're like, well, is that a success? Is that what the objective is? And it really isn't, but that's how they're measuring themselves in terms of how filled they can get their homeless shelters. You're also an advocate for prototyping, and I believe it should really be a backbone of local government's efforts to improve services and develop new policies and programs. But this, too, is virtually unknown in the public sector. Why do you think prototyping is so rare, Jim, and how have you seen it work in the public sector?
It's such a great question, and I'm delighted that you're asking about it. So prototyping, as you're aware, and I'm sure most of your listeners are aware, is a commonly used tool in the private sector. When companies want to develop a new product or a new service, they don't start by convening the experts within the organization, building a fully fledged product and foisting it into the world and making an announcement. They do the absolute opposite of that, which is they start building very small, low-fidelity versions of that new product or new service, and they immediately begin engaging end users. They want to understand how that cheap, easy, risk-free model interacts in real people's lives, whether they can intuit how it works, how it will hang with other things that they've got happening in their daily lives. And they learn from those interactions. They bring the lessons back into the development process. They incorporate it, and then they circle back and do it again.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time they've gone through that product development process, they've tested every core assumption. They've tested their hypotheses. There's no button. There's no knob. There's no design decision that hasn't been experienced by small groups of users. And so the product developers know that it's going to work.
Mm-hmm.
In some ways, if you just think about it, that flies in the face of the way that we've trained up public sector employees. There's so much fear in the public sector that you would ever talk about something that is unbaked, undeveloped, not ready for prime time. There's such a fear that the press will attack, that citizens will pounce, that we've leaned heavily on experts and on asking the experts within government and sometimes within our provider circles to help us develop those new products and services, and then we launch them into the world. What we're saying is this is a really powerful way for governments that want to innovate more effectively to act. Prototyping a new public intervention simply means starting with a cheap, low-fidelity model, testing it with your homeless individuals, understanding if they get it, how it would work, can they actually use it and make sense of it, and taking lots of notes and bringing them back into your product development, into your product development loop.
Mm-hmm.
We're now doing this with 35 cities across the country on a wide range of public solutions. And the thing that's just incredible about it is they're pivoting radically in the way that they're envisioning their public innovations. They're getting critical feedback from their users that they're bringing back into their product development. By the time these cities launch these new ideas, they're going to have so much confidence that they've worked out the kinks and that they've got a product that real people are actually going to want to use.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not something we're training people to do in our public administration schools. This is a tool and a technique that, you know, very, very few cities are using in the world today. And we've really made it our mission to bring this tool because we think it is such a powerful, powerful way for cities to de-risk their innovations and make sure that they're failing at a small level so they don't fail in a big way later.
Yeah, very, very smart. And if I may dare say, I think a lot holds true with that in the nonprofit sector as well. And whether it's tax dollars or whether it's donors' dollars, there's this fear that the citizens or the donors are going to rebel if something fails. And I think we underestimate, you know, people. They want these kinds of experiments because they want it to work, but we're terrified. I know we are in the nonprofit sector that if I spend donor money on something that doesn't work, we'll never see more money again. Well, speaking of prototyping, it's a critical component of this year's Mayor's Challenge. The first time I think that's been the case. Tell us about the Mayor's Challenge, Jim. I think you're in your fourth year now. What is the objective, and how does that challenge work?
Mike Bloomberg is a big believer that we need to look to local governments to generate new solutions to big challenges they face on the ground in their communities, and that those solutions can spread and produce a lot of benefit for residents in other places. He loves to talk about the fact that when he was at City Hall, some of his biggest successes, bike share, closing Times Square, were actually ideas that he borrowed from other cities.
Yeah.
And so that's a real foundation stone for our work here. The Mayor's Challenge is a way that we incentivize public sector innovation. We run these large-scale competitions. They're for city halls. We're asking for mayors to develop bold, new thinking on how to address a big challenge that they face in their community. We're looking for ideas that are new and, number one, that are new, that build on the shoulders of what's come before. Number two, that have the potential to have great impact. Number three, that can actually be implemented. We don't want pie-in-the-sky ideas that have no chance of actually getting off the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And then our fourth criteria is around transferability. Are you developing a solution that will be interesting to cities in other places because they've got the same problem? And so we run these competitions. We started this in the United States. It's gone to Europe. It's gone to a version to India. It's gone to Latin America. And we brought it back to the United States last year because Mike felt and our board of directors felt very strongly that in the current context, we need to really support our cities here at home and help them generate new thinking. And so the competition's underway. It's been our most successful thus far. More cities have participated. I think somewhere close to 350 cities submitted ideas. We're now in the finalist stage with 35 great mayors generating great ideas, and we will announce the winners in Detroit in October.
So let's turn our attention to climate change. Cities are a big part of the problem. I think worldwide it's about 70% of emissions that lead to climate change come from cities, but they're also a big part of the solution. And you have an initiative looking to accelerate those solutions. Tell us about American Cities Climate Challenge.
We're really excited about this. Mike Bloomberg has served as the United Nations Special Advisor on Cities and Climate and Climate Impact for the last couple of years. And in that capacity, he has traveled the world, providing support and raising the ambitions of cities, civil society, and businesses to make a real impact on what he believes is the defining issue of our time. After the Trump administration pulled the United States away from its Paris Climate Agreement, a number of cities stood up and said, we're still in. Mike Bloomberg, along with Governor Jerry Brown, helped to coordinate cities and states that wanted to still work to achieve those Paris climate targets because at the end of the day, we still need to hit them or we're in real trouble. And as all of these cities were stepping up and saying, we're still in, our really incredible team, we have a world-class environmental portfolio and leadership here. You know, we're really recognizing that, you know, there is a strong possibility that the ambition is going to be a little bit out of step with the actual capacity to deliver against it. So cities are stepping up. They're saying that they want to achieve those climate targets on very quick timetables. Do they actually have the resources, the knowledge, the technical expertise to start that work right now and to really accelerate progress against those goals? And our conclusion is that cities really do need some help with that.
Mm-hmm.
And so the American Cities Climate Challenge is an effort that Mike and our teams have made to say, hey, if you're really serious about reforming the way that your city does transportation and buildings, these are the two primary driver for carbon pollution in most cities. If you're really serious about focusing on those two areas and really want to take your work to the next level, we will infuse millions of dollars of new resources and handholding and technical assistance into your shops to accelerate your progress. So we open that opportunity up for cities, I believe, in the late spring or the early summer. More than, I want to say, 50% or 60% of the cities that were eligible have sort of come back and said, we are in and we would love to participate. And we're now in the process of narrowing that down and interviewing cities to understand where we're going to make those commitments. I expect that you will begin hearing about the cities that will be getting Bloomberg support come September, October, somewhere around there is the time frame. It's very exciting, and it's just an opportunity for us to say, if you're really wanting to make a mark on this issue, it matters in your community, you have the partnerships in place, and you as a mayor really want to make a leadership mark here, we're going to stand with you and provide you the supports you need to get there.
Fantastic. Sounds like you got a few things going on. You know that, Jim?
Here's the thing about working for Mike Bloomberg. You know, he has a lot of money that he wants to give away, and he wants to give it away in a smart way.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
We believe that, you know, to the point that you made when you opened, you get a really good bang on your philanthropic buck when you invest in city government. When you beef up the capacity of local governments to make better decisions, to use data in the way that they're understanding the problems that they have in the community, the way that they're assessing the different interventions that they could use, the way that they're measuring their impact over time, when you help them do all of that work better, it has a cascading effect across the entire city government. And by the way, cities are where people live.
Yeah.
I think 70-80% of Americans now live in areas that we would say are sort of urban areas. And we want to make sure that people in those cities are receiving quality public services, you know, whether that's transportation or, you know, street and sidewalk repair or better schools or safer streets. We know that when local governments are using data and understanding whether what they're doing is actually improving people's lives or not, we're going to make all of that work. We're going to make that world better for people. And so yes, we have a lot going on, but we also know that when cities are your partners, your opportunity to reach so many people in a positive way is times 10.
Yeah. And it certainly seems that all the interesting things that are going on in government right now are coming out of cities much more so than states or at the federal level. Let me ask you about disruptive technologies. You know, you have Uber and Lyft and ride sharing. You have Airbnb with home sharing platforms. And there's disruptions in healthcare and ticket sales. What are you seeing? Are regulatory changes or other kinds of adaptations?
Well, this is a big topic. I think the conflict between emerging technologies and so-called disruptive technologies and local governments, I think we've only seen the first chapter of what will be a long and salacious novel. We just finished, actually about 6 or 8 months ago, a year of working with 10 global cities on the issue of autonomous vehicles. Mm. And cities everywhere are intrigued by this technology. We wanted to help cities muscle up, understand what the state of the world looked like, who's doing what kinds of pilots, what are the potentials for these technologies. And the thing that we really came away with from that entire experience is, number one, there are incredible information asymmetries between the technology companies and the people in local government. That's a real challenge. If folks in local government don't understand the technologies, it's really complicated to negotiate a good partnership that puts citizens at the center and elevates citizen needs. So number one, there's a need for assistance for local governments. Number two, what we're hearing from mayors is that the big lesson that they've learned from Airbnb and Uber is that they can't sit in the passenger seat of those relationships. Urban ecosystems are delicate ecosystems. You have to put civic values and civic aspirations at the center of the conversations with these disruptive and emerging technologists. And I think what we're beginning to see is mayors figuring out how they can have a strong, smart, you know, affirmative and equal role in those negotiations so that they can articulate what matters for me as the leader of the civic and what matters to my citizens and how do we work with you to allow you to innovate and drive all of the incredible job growth and opportunity, but to do it in a way that aligns with our civic values. I'll give you a great example of that. Sam Liccardo is the mayor of San Jose, California, not so far from Silicon Valley. And many, many technology companies, and particularly those on the West Coast, wanted to start exploring autonomous vehicles on his streets. And he said, you know what? You're welcome to pilot activities on our streets, but I want to see pilots that help me achieve things that matter to us, like connecting poor people to economic opportunity. I would welcome pilots using autonomous technologies that help me connect poor people to jobs, because one of the problems that we have in our community is that poor people spend way too much time traveling and to get to their day job, and then way too much time traveling to get to their night job. Is there a way that these technologies can help make that life easier for people? And I just thought that was a great example of the city articulating a really primary challenge that it has and offering that up to technology and saying, help us with this, and we will allow you to use our streets for research and development.
So practical and so real. They're the voice of those people who are saying, I'm going back and forth and spending the better part of my day just trying to get to and fro. You know, I was reading the other day that the private sector spends about $42 billion on executive development, while in the public sector, that number has been, well, let's say, closer to zero. Yet there are very few jobs which are more important, multifaceted, and complex as being the mayor of a city, particularly a large one, which is why last year you launched the Bloomberg Harvard City Leadership Initiative. In fact, I think you just recently gathered with your second class of 40 mayors. Tell us about that program, Jim, and the impact you look forward to it having.
Your statistic at the top is the key thing that caught our attention. Mayors arguably have a much harder CEO role than their private sector counterparts. Defining success is more complicated. Turning off failing programs is more complicated. They work in constrained political environments under the scrutiny of journalists. There are many, many challenges that a public CEO has. And you know, most mayors come into office not having had a tremendous amount of executive management experience, and yet being a mayor is very much an executive role. You're managing large budgets. You're managing large numbers of people. We saw a real gap. There simply wasn't world-class leadership development opportunities available for our public CEOs. So we partnered with the business school and the Kennedy School at Harvard, and we launched a big program. We're now in our second year. I feel a little bit bad for the mayors that joined us in the first year. We were testing things on them.
Prototyping.
We were prototyping. and we just welcomed our second class into the program. And I walked away from this week both, you know, always in awe of the mayors and the energy and passion that they bring to the program, but also so impressed with our incredible partners at the Harvard University who have just developed an incredible program for these mayors. Next week, we'll be bringing, each mayor is then invited to bring two members of their senior team into a shadow program. So they come next week, and we're looking forward to having those chiefs of staff and chief policy officers here in New York.
Absolutely super. Well, you know, you sound very excited about what you do. So let me ask you about the workplace culture at Bloomberg Philanthropies. What do you find to be distinctive and unique about it that makes it such an exceptional place to work?
So a few things. Mike Bloomberg, number one, is, you know, a famous sort of manager to work for. It's great to work for Mike Bloomberg because he provides a tremendous amount of support to the team here, asks us to dream really big, helps us, you know, make sure that we're, you know, asks us a bunch of questions to make sure we've done our homework, and then, you know, provides a lot of latitude for the incredible team that we've pulled together here to do great work and to do it through incredible partnerships. So number one, you know, it's great to work for Mike. Number two, our CEO, Patty Harris, has really focused on collaboration and openness. We work in an open environment. We're all seated around one another so that we're not siloed off one team against the next. And she's really promoting a culture here where we're trying to leverage the strengths across our different portfolios. I think in a lot of philanthropic organizations, I have a lot of friends that work in philanthropy, and I think one of the challenges that many of the older organizations deal with are very entrenched silos within those philanthropies. And I would say that one of Patty's key missions is to make sure that we build a different kind of culture here. And you and I talked a moment ago about the American Cities Climate Challenge. That's a really great example of a program that was inspired by insights that our environmental team had and that we have worked in the government team collaboratively with the environment team to sort of, you know, we've become expert at doing these competitions, and so they're the climate experts. And so rather than retreating to our own silos, we work together to do something that neither of us could probably have done on our own. And I think that's really a value that Patty and the leadership here has tried to put into place, and that's fun. You know, it's really, it's a different way of working in the world, and it just means there's so many more yeses than there are noes, and that's a fun place to come every day.
Fun does count, that's for sure. Well, let me close with this, Jim. You probably know more mayors in the world today as much as anyone. What are some of the aspects of being a mayor, a big city mayor especially, that most citizens would be unaware of or at least not fully appreciate?
You know, I know as many small and mid-sized mayors as large mayors at this point. So one, let me just say that. Our program now, you know, we just had the mayor from Cheyenne, Wyoming, sitting next to the mayor of Sao Paulo,
Brazil. Great picture.
You know, so one of the world's largest cities and a very differently sized American city. And, you know, it's really interesting. I think being a great mayor, you know, obviously we talked about you need to be a good manager, and being a good manager, we know what that means. That's about and picking smart people, you know, using data, not ideology, to guide decision making, using, you know, empowering people and giving them latitude, support, encouraging them to take risks and supporting them when they make intelligent failures. All of that, I think, is really important. I think the critical tool that mayors are trying to acquire today that is, I think, more important than ever and probably more top of mind than it was 10 years ago. Number one, how do we engage citizens effectively? This is something every mayor everywhere is focused on, and we can talk a little bit about why that is. And then the second is, how do we collaborate? Mayors have a lot of unfunded mandates. They're being asked to deal with a lot of issues that national governments are not satisfactorily addressing, whether that's climate change or mass migration or anything, any number of other issues, and they cannot do it alone. And so mayors are very focused on how do we bring partners from civil society, academia, business to the table, articulate shared goals, and then manage together. And that also, I think, is really what makes a mayor a great mayor, is the ability to sort of think in that way and to think about partnerships as a major sort of way that they do the public's work. The mayors that look more narrowly at the levers of local government are the mayors that I think have a harder time because the solutions are smaller, the ambitions are contained, and we just know that it's not enough. And so So I'm seeing more and more mayors that are coming to us, you know, even in the application process for our Harvard program, mayors are saying, I need to get better at citizen engagement. Will this program help us? I need to get better at collaboration. Will this program help us? So that's, I think, a really exciting thing that we're seeing emerge. And I think is an important, critical part of being a good mayor today.
Well, your third class might have more than 40 mayors the way you're going. Well, James Anderson, the head of government innovation programs at Bloomberg Philanthropies, thanks for joining me tonight. Tell us about your website and what's on it for those who are interested in learning more.
So please check out our website. It's a great place to go to get a great sense of the totality of our work, whether you're interested in, you know, the deep arts and cultural investments we're making in cities across the country, the climate change work that we discussed today. Go to www.bloomberg.org. Our web team is terrific. You'll see on the website an opportunity to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. If you are a government innovation person, if you're interested in all things public sector innovation, look for the subscription opportunity to the Spark newsletter. We send out a weekly briefing on the work that we're doing. Please check it out.
Thanks, Jim. This was a fascinating conversation, and it was a real pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
I'll be back with more of the Business of Giving right after this.
Before you give to charity, go to charitynavigator.org. Charity Navigator provides free ratings of thousands of America's largest charities, helping you get the most out of your charitable dollar. Charitynavigator.org, your guide to intelligent giving. Through Grameen America's groundbreaking microfinance model, tens of thousands of low-income women in New York are getting the financial capital they need to build small businesses and climb out of poverty. Join the movement. Visit GrameenAmerica.org to learn more. follow the Business of Giving on Twitter at BizOfGive and at Facebook.com/BusinessOfGiving. And now, back to the Business of Giving with your host, Denver Frederick, on AM 970, The Answer.
Listening knows of at least one person who has volunteered to help build a simple, decent, and affordable house as part of Habitat for Humanity, the largest nonprofit builder in the world. There's an awful lot that goes into this, not just in the United States, but in the nearly 70 countries where they operate. And here to walk us through it all is Jonathan Reckford, the Chief Executive Officer of Habitat for Humanity International. Good evening, Jonathan, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Good evening, Denver. Thanks for having me on your show.
Why don't we begin by having you give us some of the history of the organization, which might be useful since almost everyone I know thinks that Habitat was founded by President and Mrs. Carter.
You know, Denver, it's so true. I think that the two things people know most about Habitat turn out not to be true. One, that President and Mrs. Carter founded Habitat, which is not true, though we can certainly talk about how they put it on the map. And that the second is that we give away houses, which is also a misconception. But Habitat was actually started, the backstory is a quite remarkable pastor named Clarence Jordan. In 1942, started an interracial farm in Southwest Georgia. And you can imagine how popular that was in Southwest Georgia in 1942. Mm-hmm. And so the farm always struggled. They were boycotted, bombed, harassed. But he had an extraordinary influence on a large number of pastors and social leaders and was a great believer in nonviolent social justice. And he, in the 60s, gathered a group together. The farm was really struggling to think about what might be next. And out of that time of prayer and deliberation came this idea of a fund for humanity, where they would surround sharecropping farmers who were living in these terrible shacks, build them a proper house, and then give them a no-profit loan that they would then pay back, and then actually in the spirit of community, keep making payments after they'd paid it back so that the fund would be sustainable and their repayments would help the next family have the opportunity to have a loan. And our founder, Millard Fuller, was part of that group and part of that original test group, and he then took the idea to Africa, what was then Zaire, and tested it for 3 years and came back in 1976 and officially started Habitat for Humanity, and really spread as a grassroots movement. He was very charismatic, and if you sat on a plane with Millard, by the time you got off the plane, you'd start Habitat wherever you were. And so it just really bloomed across the world. And then a pivotal moment really was in 1984 when President Mrs. Carter got involved. Mm-hmm. And I actually just did the checking. I think cumulatively between 76 and 84, we had built 758 houses across the world. And you can really see the inflection point. After the Carters got involved, Habitat got a huge amount of attention, and their continued presence and so many people getting involved and taking leadership, we've now been able to help over 13 million people worldwide have new or improved housing. So it has it's been exciting to see. But the basic idea and core principle has held all the way along. Clarence had a wonderful quote. He said, "What the poor need is not charity but capital, mm-hmm. not caseworkers but co-workers. And what the rich need is a wise, honorable, and just way of divesting themselves of their overabundance." And he had this view that everyone had something to give and everyone had something to gain by working together. And that spirit of Habitat has always been that way. So volunteers come, we do subsidize the loans to make them affordable, but there's always been an element of both sweat equity, the families actually help build their homes and their neighborhood homes, and then they pay back that affordable mortgage, and we recycle those payments in the same community, helping the next family have an opportunity to improve their living conditions. And then we also do view part of our mission is to influence the volunteers and build community. And we've seen transformation both in the lives of volunteers and in the families who are purchasing the homes.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you know, housing is often overlooked when poverty is discussed. But the ripple effects of having a stable home, whether it be for the members of the family or the community itself, they really can't be overstated, Jonathan. What are some of its impacts?
You know, housing is, as you say, so fundamental. It really is foundational for all the other things we care about. And I'm always similarly surprised that it's not higher on the priority list. What we really see, and the data is overwhelming, is the direct correlation that if a child grows up without proper housing, she doesn't stay healthy, she doesn't do as well at school, and therefore has a very low chance of being self-sufficient. If you inject good housing in, it doesn't solve everything, but we see much better health outcomes, therefore better educational outcomes, therefore the better chance of being self-sustaining economically at the end of the cycle. And we've seen over and over again families breaking that intergenerational cycle of poverty. So we really do think housing is a foundation. My growing hypothesis, Denver, about why it hasn't been higher on the list is in our increasingly economically segregated societies around the world, most of us can live our daily lives without seeing the way that our brothers and sisters in other parts of our same cities might be living. So it's not visceral in the way that we can all relate to health and education. But I think when you talk to someone who's experienced poverty housing, you know, after food and water, it is the most basic need in terms of creating a decent life.
Yeah, we don't have very many mixed residential communities, that's for sure. You know, you mentioned before that you've helped over 13 million people since its founding. How many of them have been in the United States, and how many of them been in those other 70 or so countries?
I think people are often surprised because we have such a broad footprint in the U.S. with our 1,300 local Habitat chapters, that the great majority of the families we serve are actually outside the U.S. Part of that, of course, is the cost per home is much lower, and part of that is the ability to do some market development work that has allowed us to scale faster in some countries around the world, and we can talk more about that. So if you looked at the current mix, historically probably it would be about 15 to 20% of our work domestic, but currently it's approaching 95% of the individuals we're touching outside the U.S.
Yeah, that is surprising, I think, to a lot of people. What's the nature of the relationship that you have with these national offices and these affiliate organizations and the relationship they have with the international organization?
So we directly relate to them. They really own the local work. So if you're in the U.S. and you'd be working with your local Habitat, they're a local 501c3 nonprofit.
Mm-hmm.
And our role is to both equip and support them as well as uphold the standards and protect and grow the brand. So in some ways, it's not exactly a franchise, but almost works like that in the U.S. Internationally, we have a much bigger role in the direct funding and operations of some of the countries. But the same philosophy. We've always had a philosophy of it should be locally owned. You know, I loved meeting a new staff member in Indonesia who was very surprised to find that a Habitat existed outside Indonesia. And, you know, they viewed it as a local, their Indonesian nonprofit. And I think that's actually terrific.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you cleared up one of the misconceptions I think a lot of people have before about the fact that you don't give away these homes. But let's get into a little bit more detail as to how this program works. How do you go about deciding what families will be eligible for it, and what are their responsibilities and obligations?
So we have a variety of programs, but the basic program would be there are three criteria to partner with Habitat. The first is we only work with low-income families. If a bank would give them a loan, we would typically not work with them. So we're serving families that are between usually 30 and 60% of the area median income.
Mm-hmm.
The second is the willingness to partner. And so we do treat them, they have to be ready to buy a home. So there's a whole preparation where they have to actually, in addition to sweat equity of helping build their home and their neighbors' homes, they have to take classes in financial management and home maintenance so that they're really well prepared by the time. And they also have to have clean credit and to demonstrate the ability to pay back that affordable mortgage. And so those are the three pieces. If they're low income, willing to partner, and demonstrate the ability to pay back that affordable mortgage, then we work with them. Unfortunately, as you can imagine, there's far more demand than we have land and resources to supply, so it is a competitive process, and it's always heartbreaking to turn families away. And then what's really exciting, though, is that amount of preparation has led to a remarkable success. If you think about it, we're technically a sub-subprime lender.
Yep.
But one of my favorite stories, with all the pain of the recession, when we had people across all income bands defaulting on their loans across the United States, Habitat's foreclosure rate went up to only 2%.
Wow.
So even though we're lending to very low-income families, that preparation commitment, and in some ways, of course, the basics, we're lending them a mortgage they can actually afford on about 30% of their income, and then we're giving them the preparation and tools, and they're purchasing a very simple, energy-efficient home that they know how to take care of. And so it's, in some ways, the basics we think are there that maybe all housing organizations should follow.
Yeah, yeah. And looking at this issue from a broader perspective, let's talk about affordable housing. How many people in this country are paying more than 30%, whether it be for their mortgage or for their rent?
So, shockingly, we have got I think, is now 19 million households paying more than 30% of their income, and of that, close to half of them paying more than half of their income on their rent or mortgage. And if you think about that, by definition, that means they're having to forego either costs for education, for medical, for food, for other constraints. And so it really does create a hardship. And even more, if you think about your true housing costs as the cost of your rent or mortgage plus your utility plus transportation to get to work, sort of the full cost of housing, it's actually much worse than that. Where we, because often people are having to go far away to find affordable rents in our cities.
Yeah, families are having to make some horrific choices. Volunteers are the real backbone of your program, Jonathan. Tell us how you go about recruiting, managing, and then training people to build a house, some who, like me, have no idea of what they're doing. And, of course, you're mindful of safety, their safety all the while.
Yeah, we take that last part incredibly seriously. So we have actually this amazing group of hardcore volunteers are called our caravanners, who actually go around the country. They're self-sufficient, and they do trainings for all our affiliates on good safety practices. And we have safety certifications to make sure that we do create a safe environment. I think one of the ahas that we've had really is that the reason we use volunteers is less a construction strategy, though we're very excited to have our volunteers come out and build, but really it's part of the overall social change strategy. So what we're trying to do, what we really want, is when you come out for that Habitat experience, and I had my first one when I was working for the Walt Disney Company more than 25 years ago, we want that to be an on-ramp to getting engaged in the issues of affordable housing, not an end in itself. And so our hope is that when people come out, they have this powerful experience, maybe working in a part of town they've never been in, maybe working with families in an economic strata that they're not used to, have not usually done. And what we see is mutual respect and learning coming out of that. And our hope is, out of that volunteer experience, they will become advocates and supporters of better housing policy, that they would become, we'd love them to become donors, and also break down the idea that the only way to volunteer is through construction. So we have wonderful skilled volunteers who are board members, who are mentors to the families, who are engaged in bringing their financial skills or legal skills or advocacy skills. So there are a huge number of ways that you can get involved that don't necessarily involve construction for those who don't want to put on a hard hat.
Yeah, well, that's a very, very smart strategy, and I think getting them involved in the ecosystem is just the way to go. You know, another misconception that people have, which I don't think is quite as widespread, is that Habitat solely builds new homes. But you're very active in neighborhood revitalization as well, correct?
That's right. And we've always done a mix, but I would say, you know, if you can bring good out of bad, the huge housing crisis of 2008 and the recession accelerated the amount of work we were doing in terms of mix. So historically, we did majority whole houses and then a minority of rehabs and repairs. So we've always done some of both. I think the biggest mindset shift that we're really excited, that actually brought our U.S. affiliates more in line with our global work, was to not just think about how many houses can we build, but changing the framing question to what would it take to meaningfully reduce the housing deficit in each geography that we work. And that led to, along with the housing crisis, some really exciting movements by our affiliates to make long-term commitments to specific neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. And now we've got over 300 affiliates who are doing this deep neighborhood revitalization, where they've either started or joined coalitions that are really thinking holistically about addressing the needs of a community. And we're going to stay focused on housing, but we fully recognize that we also need people that are thinking about education and improving the schools, people thinking about livelihoods and jobs. You need the city to partner in terms of public safety. We need food. You need all the elements of a healthy community. And we've really seen some beautiful examples over time where we've seen transformation happen, but it does take a coalition approach, and that coalition approach actually needs to start with the community itself.
You really
got to find the sometimes informal, sometimes formal leaders in the community and get them to own the vision of what they want their community to become, and then think about what partners could come in and support that vision.
Well, I can see you've moved to outcomes from outputs. You know,
yes.
Under your leadership, Habitat Disaster Risk and Reduction and Response Program has flourished. Now, I know that each disaster is different, but generally, how do you go about focusing your response in these difficult and trying circumstances?
Yeah, thanks, Denver. You know, part of when I first joined Habitat, you know, I had my carefully laid out 100-day plan, and then Hurricane Katrina hit right before I started, and that, of course, threw it all out the window.
Sure.
And the combination of that, that year was really a pivotal year for us because we had the, if you remember, the Indian Ocean tsunami had happened just that winter,
yep.
And then Katrina. So we had two of the largest global housing disasters in modern history happen that year. And those challenged us, rather than building a few houses in a lot of places, to think about how do we have a scale of impact in concentrated spaces. And that's when we formalized our disaster response program.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really exciting. We helped over 25,000 families build back after the tsunami in Asia. And in across the Gulf Coast of the U.S., we ended up building over 5,000 homes, and then and helping repair a large number more than that. And it was, and that was more, you know, a bigger concentrated effort than we had ever done before. And we learned a lot from that. It also allowed us to test and innovate some things that maybe wouldn't have been culturally okay in a non-disaster environment. But I think philosophically, what we realized is that when these natural or man-made disasters happen, they're almost always housing disasters.
Mm-hmm,
and
right.
So it was very much on mission. We're not a relief organization, but we recognize that we really should be part of the long-term rebuilding of these communities. And so it's become, in any given year, about 20% of our global work. And unfortunately, this past year was a really bad year for disasters. We had the U.S. and Caribbean hurricanes. We had earthquakes in Mexico. We had terrible flooding in Asia. And then fires, and it just keeps on coming. Even as today, we're praying for our friends in Hawaii that,
mm-hmm.
That the hurricane will bypass or soften. So our strategy for our disaster response is the idea of a pathway to permanence. So we often will try to respond right away with volunteers in the cleanup phase. One thing we often do is distribute shelter kits that would allow a family to quickly put up temporary shelter or have the tools to do minor repairs on their own while the early in the process that helps them stay close to their land and community. And then we want to come back and be part of the permanent rebuilding. And so we have a big initiative we're deep in the middle of called Habitat Hammers Back, which is our response to the three hurricanes that hit the U.S. and Puerto Rico last year and the Caribbean. But we've also got active disaster response going on in many places in the world right now.
Yeah, well, Habitat has a great reputation for being there for the long run, and we have, I think, what people refer to as that CNN moment, where everybody's there, everybody pays attention, but then the attention goes elsewhere, and that's when you guys really step up and really help the families over the long term when everybody else has moved on.
It's actually a great point for your listeners, Denver. Thank you, and I should have said, it's interesting, about 80% of the giving goes to that relief effort,
mm-hmm.
meaning only 20% is there for the long-term rebuilding, which is terribly expensive, and so often we've encouraged people, yes, give to relief, but maybe think about splitting your funding and giving some to the relief, emergency relief, but then also investing in the long-term recovery, because that's a huge challenge for these communities.
Yeah. Getting back to the Carters, this year marks the 35th Jimmy and Rosalind Carter Work Project, which is starting just about now. Where is it going to be for 2018?
So this year we'll be in St. Joseph County, Indiana.
Hmm.
And there's a nice backstory there, actually. There's a wonderful architect named Leroy Troyer, who's become a dear friend. And Leroy has been the house builder on 32 of the 34 Carter projects. And so this is really to honor him. We're going to his hometown.
Oh, wow.
And building in St. Joseph County. So we will be in Mishawaka, Indiana, which is right by South Bend, where Leroy lives. And we're really excited. It's, you know, the Carters use this week every year to bring attention, not just to build homes, though it's impressive. They directly have worked alongside more than 100,000 volunteers in 14 countries and have either built, renovated, or repaired almost 4,300 homes. But the ripple effects are much greater than that, and we really use it as a way to bring new leadership into the mission, to bring awareness to the need for affordable housing, and really to put a spotlight on the work that we have ahead of us. And the Carters have been unbelievable ambassadors for our mission.
They certainly have. You know, an important source of your revenue, which helps support this work, is your over 1,000 Habitat for Humanity restores. What are those?
You know, our Habitat for Humanity restores are really a hidden gem, and we want to continue to bring more attention to them, so thank you for asking. The restores are essentially home product recycling stores, where if you were to move or remodel your house, we will take everything that could be put back into use by another family. So we would take the furniture, cabinets, appliances, toilets, doors, windows, mantels, frames, anything that could be taken and resold. We sell those products in the stores, which help both low-income families or remodelers, and then the proceeds help fund more houses for Habitat. So it's a really nice triple win.
Yeah.
Last year, it generated over $450 million in sales, and it kept a couple hundred thousand tons out of landfill. So it's an environmental win, and it's really a win for the community, as well as a way to leverage philanthropy. So when families give to Habitat, they're giving, and then the affiliate is both leveraging that giving with the mortgage payments from the families and the proceeds from the restores, and that really creates an opportunity. One thing that's important is these stores, of course, are open to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And we find that both for low-income families in the community, it's a great source of low-cost products, but also for the sort of self-improvement people or the people in old houses that want to find that right doorknob or architectural window, they're a great treasure find as well. So it's I think it's been a wonderful story, and we hope to continue to grow it.
You know, Habitat has been at this work now for over 40 years, and I'm sure you're always tweaking the model to make it more effective and more meaningful and better. What are some of your current challenges and things you're looking to improve upon?
You know, I think the first challenge actually goes back to where we started the conversation, is can we get housing higher on the public agenda?
Mm-hmm.
I think in the U.S. it's interesting. It's actually gotten so bad, we have a big enough crisis now, that the Council of Mayors, for the first time that I'm aware, said affordable housing was the number one issue in our country, which means at least finally maybe there may be more room. So I would say first is that challenge of making the connection of why housing should be a high priority for people's time, energy, and investment. I think the second is even people who are generically supportive of housing often get less supportive when it's in their community. So
mm-hmm.
how do we actually educate people? And it's why our volunteer programs actually are so important, because it starts to create empathy and understanding and relationship. So it's not those people. It becomes individual people who have the same hopes, dreams, and aspirations. So we need to break down those barriers in a way that is more welcoming to building mixed income communities, because the inequality data is quite clear that children who grow up in concentrated poverty have very little social mobility, which turns out to be bad for everyone,
yeah.
Whereas low-income children who grow up in mixed-income communities actually have very high social mobility because they're given the chance. And I think Habitat is all about that hand up, not a handout, or creating that opportunity. But how do we broaden that conversation to reach more people, and how do we do that? So we're going to – that goes to more advocacy, but it continues to be a challenge. I would say in terms of constraint, like most nonprofits, and you could – it's a sort of chicken and egg – we always need more money, and we always need stronger leadership. And if you have more money, it's easier to get more leaders. If you have great leaders, they can get more money. But we're always trying to build better and deeper leadership at all of the places that we work, and continuing to attract really high capacity leaders in a very competitive workspace. You know, is an ongoing challenge for us.
Yeah, that too will always be a work in progress. Let me close with this, Jonathan. Habitat is a self-described Christian housing ministry, and after stints on Wall Street and with several major corporations, you were the executive pastor of a church when the call came about this job. What is the role of faith in the work of Habitat for Humanity, and how does it inform your leadership of the organization?
You know, I think faith has always been central to Habitat's work in terms of the motivation. So if you look at our mission statement, the first part of the mission statement is about God's love in action. We're not mm-hmm. a church or a religious organization. We're a service organization. But the motivation behind that is really to be a demonstration of God's love to all God's people, regardless of their background or their personal beliefs. The center of our mission statement is that we bring people together. And I think one of the beautiful things that pulled me to Habitat is the way that it does actually break down barriers. We were joking before, but around the world, you know, the first Habitat in Africa was built in a no-man's land between warring tribes, and we've been pioneers, whether it's in Northern Ireland between Catholics and Protestants, South Africa between blacks and whites, Egypt between Christians and Muslims. We've been all about actually lowering barriers. One of my heroes, Desmond Tutu,
mm-hmm.
Archbishop Tutu, sponsored a build every year for many years in South Africa with us. And he said, you know, as the physical walls of the home go up, the invisible walls that separate us as people come tumbling down, and hope is built in the community. And I think, to me, that's such a beautiful picture of what faith and action should look like in our increasingly polarized world. And so one of the informal phrases we use internally is God is our center but not our border, that we are motivated by our faith but joyfully welcome everyone and want to live in that tension of being radically inclusive and not giving up that central motivation. But we recognize that we have many Habitat supporters for whom that's not their primary motivation, but that's Habitat's organizational motivation.
Mm-hmm. Well, well stated. Well, Jonathan Reckford, the CEO of Habitat for Humanity International, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. How does someone become involved as a volunteer, maybe to contribute, maybe to find where some of these restores are?
Well, we would love it. The simplest way is just go to habitat.org, and there's a whole section on Get Involved, and you can quickly do a search and find your local Habitat organization. You can find your local restore, and you can find ways to get involved and volunteer. And I would just say, please come join us. I can't tell you how many volunteers have come up and thanked me for the opportunity to come out and really experience the kind of community that we all want to be a part of but too rarely feel. And I think that's been the secret sauce that has made Habitat an enduring mission.
Well, let me thank you, Jonathan. It was a real pleasure to have you on the program.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
And that is this week's show. Next week, my guests will be Jacqueline Fuller, the president of Google.org and the Google Foundation. I'm really looking forward to that. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. And I hope you'll return next Sunday evening for The Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of The Business of Giving.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.